Great to have you along for Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Growing up, there were a couple of rules in Seth Kantner's life. When he and his brother went outside, he had to always carry matches, dress warm, and he wasn't allowed to shoot anything the family couldn't eat or use in some way. Those are the ground rules when you grow up north of the Arctic Circle, living off the land. It's a life that Kantner embraced and shares with readers in his new book, A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou. And he's going to share it with us today. Welcome, Seth, to Constant Wonder.
Oh, thank you so much.
So I'd like you to describe the home that you grew up in.
Our first sod igloo was about 14 feet in, I'll say, diameter across the floor, a dirt floor, and had a tunnel that you crawled in. You came up there at the floor, wood stove and sort of sloping walls, pretty low to keep the heat near you. And then we slept on caribou hides and cooked on the wood stove. One window, which was Sears Roebuck back then, sold a product called Visqueen, which was sort of clear plastic. Mm-hmm. And that was the window. So it flapped in the wind horribly. That tunnel was the old Eskimo style entrance to a sod and also snow igloos. You know, where I lived is further south than the, you know, high Arctic. And so there was materials where you could make a home out of moss and spruce or poles or logs. And further north, the sort of stereotypical igloo is made out of snow because they didn't have those materials. So that was our home. On the floor,
was it warm? Was it warm? Yeah, that's what I want to know about the temperature. How'd you keep warm?
Well, it's like standing around a campfire in a sense. You know, the stove is sort of melting one side of your body, and then the other side is maybe cold. That tunnel, because it was in the north wind, would suck the warm air out of the house. But I was born in that sod igloo. But if you were, you know, an adult up high or hung your mittens up, it might be 70 or 80 degrees up there. And then on the floor, good luck not having your cup of coffee freeze. So yeah, very nice. And then of course, lots of mice and shrews running around on the floor because they didn't have anything keeping them out. And it's a nice warm place in their estimation.
Tell me, in the area that you lived, I want to go way back. You know, I think outsiders would think of it as a cold wasteland. But what did the first settlers find attractive about this place where you grew up? And what's the name? Was there a town?
So the first people to cross the Bering Land Bridge would be, you know, the Native Americans and the And then in the, you know, time period, I was born in 1965. So at that point, Inupiaq Eskimos had been living there for, you know, thousands of years. My parents moved north in the 60s, part of a little bit of a national back to the land movement where there was upheaval with probably Vietnam War and civil rights and different upheavals, but on a smaller scale were this sort of back to the land movement. Where I was born and raised is on the Kobuk River, 70 or 80 miles above the Arctic Circle, on the south side of the Brooks Range, which is rather well known now. And 30 miles up the river was a small Inupiaq Eskimo village.
And what did, like, they lived there for thousands of years. What drew them there?
Well, I'm sitting in the new school in that village now. There's still a couple hundred people here, but a lot of modernity, you know, satellite, every phones and everybody has a cell phone, et cetera. What drew the people to all the sort of spots they settled thousands of years ago were animals. And in this case, halfway between where I was born and this village here is a place called Onion Portage, where caribou, the land sort of funnels thousands and thousands of caribou to cross the river. So it's this point where the natives could traditionally capture large quantities of meat. And then, as I say in my book, even more important was the caribou hides or caribou furs, which are so insulative and so important for winter parkas and mukluks and all sorts of sleeping skins, all sorts of other items that were essential to survival at that time.
And I want to hear a little bit about your childhood. You and your brother's name is Cole, is that right?
That's correct, yeah. So it's hard to even figure it out now because my parents were so strange. I mean, they're from Ohio, Toledo and Cleveland separately, and they met at the University of Alaska. My dad went up to Alaska when he was 17 to, it was still a territory, to attend college. And then my mom went up, I think, 7 years later, maybe 1960, because the university was trying to import some women. There were hardly any. So they gave her free tuition or something. So at the University of Alaska, that's in Fairbanks, you know, there were sort of all American things like electricity and cars and probably restaurants and some of that stuff. When they came north here, the village of Ambler here had been recently settled from further upriver and had, you know, obviously no electricity, no phone, really cut off, especially in winter. You felt like the outside world was, you know, another planet almost.
And they thought this would be a good place to settle and raise a family.
Here's the crazy thing. I just described the village, but instead of staying in that very isolated village, they headed down the river and found this hill and dug a hole in it and a cave, basically, a sod igloo. And that's where I was born. And then I think, you know, the blurry past of history, I think my dad was, you know, totally in love with this crazy life of running dogs and hunting every day. And then my mom was, you know, pregnant in the cave. Her experience was largely different than his, you know, taking care of children. And he's out there skinning bears and hauling firewood and whatever. my life was in some ways confusing mix of just absolute old Eskimo lifestyle of sleeping on caribou hides and eating frozen raw meat. And then at the same time, you know, once a year, boxes of school supplies coming from the state of Alaska, which my mom would teach us spelling and grammar, and we'd read about cities and history. And so it was quite a mix of the two worlds. But I got to say one more thing, I guess, is that as far as community, you know, the rarest thing we saw was a human. And old Inupiaq hunters stopped and spent the night and told stories, and travelers, everybody stopped. That's how it worked back then. And your responsibility was care for any stranger you met at any time, and they could stay and eat your food as long as they wanted. But it was definitely this, I guess the point I'm trying to get to is I've never really been part of a human community. I've always been way more comfortable out in nature, where the animals make sense and the wind and the trees all do what they do. And my parents didn't just go to, you know, far north, but we're pretty isolated from, you know, humanity.
And it sounds like your dad was really loving this kind of wildlife. And it's hard to know maybe what your mom thought as a young child, but have you, you know, as you've gotten older, did you get a sense from her? How was it, Mom? Did you, were you having fun, or were you, you know, was this a really tough life for you?
It was really tough for her. As I've gotten older, I've realized that some people are sort of inside people and other people are outside people. And my mom's an inside person. And so if you like being inside and your only option is to be in this one cave, it's not like you could go to anybody else's house or any shopping or any civic building or anything. There just was zero of that, unless we went to the village, which was a very arduous trip, early dog team, and then later by, you know, old ancient snowmobile that break down. And And then people in the village had very small cabins, and you'd stay a day or two and then return to your, sod igloo. And so, if the great outdoors is your choice, like my dad, to this day, he just loves being outside all the time.
And as a child, did you
It's
kind of follow his lead? I can imagine that maybe young boys would just love that, especially with it
yeah,
sounds
I
like your parents
did.
gave
I
you a lot
mean,
of freedom.
we were supposed to, watch for bears and be ready to climb a tree, or definitely falling through the ice was the biggest danger and stuff like that. But they also, it's funny looking back, when I was four, I got run over by a freight sled and my leg broke, and my parents never went to the hospital all, nothing. I mean, it was just deal with it. Looking back, I realized that there was a lot of things that were just hardships for all of us, but I guess your perspective is, oh, this is normal. You're cold, being cold wasn't even kind of on our radar. You just shiver, until you're warm. And as I'm older, I realize I've become really soft and spoiled. And I still live here. I still live. I just came up from the sod house, the new sod house, to do this interview. But I look at what we used to call normal, and now I think it's called, terrible hardship or something, Same thing with all aspects of, like, oh, are there some maggots on your meat? Oh, well, cut them off, or oh, it looks like they already got boiled, or all these different perspectives that if you live in a more comfortable environment, then you're like, oh, I don't want to eat that. So everything about life yeah, you could say it was pretty hard back then, but then of course our perspective was different.
I would like to kind of try to get a sense of the romance, which I think you capture beautifully because you're a wildlife photographer as well as an author, and you capture them beautifully in your book. Seth Kantner, the book is A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou, and it's has a lot of beautiful pictures as well as the essays in history. So I've never seen caribou in the wild, and I'd like you to just kind of try to describe for us. Or how do you tell outsiders, what a herd of caribou coming over the horizon looks like?
Well, in the spring, for example, our house is on a bluff, built into the ground. So you kind of come now we have a door, homemade door, but you come out and you look out over the ice, and you see these lines of dark dots coming towards you, or just, not darker than the ice. And here comes these bands of caribou that can at times just fill the river. And when I say river there, the river's a quarter mile wide. It's a big river. And animals just flow out onto the ice. And then at times they would, when they came to shore, walking on the ice, they would come right up the hill where our sod house is, and then flow, under the clothesline or around behind the log cache, or a couple times even the herd would divide and flow on both sides of our house. And looking at it now, it's just it's a wonder of the natural world. As a kid, I would have greatly preferred to be able to watch Dukes of Hazzard on TV or something fun, but it was still impressive as a kid. But it was kind of like in springtime that would ha every day caribou were often in sight. Anytime you look, coming this massive herd of caribou migrating hundreds of miles north to the calving grounds. And so I guess, as I said before, it's very interesting to me the human perspective of how you can be like focusing on these animals, like, oh, that one looks like a good one to get to eat. Or as I got more into photography, focusing on, like, wow, this is a perfect amazing photograph of what this herd really is about. And then now that caribou are not migrating through like they used to, then it's this emptiness on the land, where you can almost feel Their absence in all ways, you know, less bears and eagles and ravens calling. And so there are just this, that number of caribou, the herd, this migratory herd went up almost as high as 500,000 before it started, the population started dropping 10, 12 years ago. So their absence is the biggest thing we're feeling now.
Do you know how many are come through nowadays?
Well, the herd has dropped about in half, so it's about 250,000, which is still like one of the largest migratory wildlife herds in the world. But they're also not migrating in the same way, so they're not coming through where we're used to seeing them. I know that this book is called, you know, Thousand Trails Home: Living with Caribou, as if I'm talking about, oh, I've been living with caribou, but I really want people to understand that what I'm really talking about here is this is part of all of our lives. This is the last of the giant herds in North America and last of a few left in the world, and what all that means to us living on Earth if we don't protect these animals.
And yeah, I'd like to know how, when you're talking to outsiders or, you know, people from the lower 48 about the importance of caribou, what's the most effective way that you have of kind of driving home that we all need to care about them?
Wow, that's a good question. And I, you know, wish you'd answer it for me. my book or my novel Ordinary Wolves came out in 2004. And at that point I had to sort of divide my life between this subsistence living off the land life that I'm describing with you know, book tours to the lower 48. And at that point we were suffering great climate change effects here in Northwest Alaska. We're kind of ground zero on the planet for climate change. So I had a terrible time trying to express my concern over climate change to people in the lower 48 and Canada, because the results of that change hadn't really hit there yet. And and this year I'm feeling like the lower 48 finally like, oh, this is the real thing. But here in Northwest Alaska, the changes have been so severe for so many years that we're all immersed in it. That's why the caribou aren't migrating like they used to. And the ice is thin and dangerous and people are drowning and the trees are growing, you know, crazy huge and all sorts of other things. So to answer your question, you know, how do I now set off on this journey again to the lower 48 and say, hey, you need to be fearful for the loss of these great herds of wild animals. I don't know how to tell folks that it affects their future food supply. I mean, they're not eating caribou, but it's all tied together. Let me say one other quick thing that, you know, one of the things I describe in my book is how when the whalers came north after whale oil in the 1850s, they brought guns, and then pretty soon all the, you know, traditional hunters in Alaska had guns. And so this caribou herd I'm describing was maybe not wiped out, nearly wiped out, but became very small, and people were starving and freezing to death because of the lack of caribou. And then they slowly came back, the caribou. And so we've had a window into what can happen, what happened to the indigenous people here without caribou the last time. And so maybe that would be my best example, is some of the elders saying, you know, when starvation comes again, instead of saying if starvation comes, they're very clear that it's when it returns.
When you were growing up, what was your relationship like with the native Eskimo people there? Were you very involved in their culture? Because it sounds like you were so isolated from everybody.
That's a very complex question. And nowadays there's obviously a lot of pitfalls of, you know, race relations. At that point, on a sort of stereotypical broader scale, these strange back to the lander people that came up were, you know, largely white people, and they were very interested in the old ways. In the villages, once again, on a stereotypical level, the natives were very interested in not doing the old ways and, you know, acquiring plywood and Levi's and 7-Up and before too long TVs. And so there was this weird dichotomy of the back to the landers wanting to learn the old ways, and then the natives, you know, still having a lot of old ways, but in their case, wanting the new, you know. And then, you know, as the years went by, there's been some resurgence in local native people wanting to relearn the old ways and do the old ways. And in some ways, it's almost too late. There's a lot of invasion of nylon and cell phones and technology and aluminum boats and everything that, you know, American stuff. It's hard to go back and say, so how did we tan caribou hides? And what time of year do you have to get caribou hides if you're going to make mukluks or caribou parkas? And so there's a huge amount of lost information and then sort of waves of interest in that past. I didn't learn Inupiaq Eskimo. In the village, people, so-called young people, I'm 56, but at that point, there was a great demarcation where people stopped learning the language. So if you have somebody here now who's like 2 years older than me, all those people know how to speak Inupiaq. And people who are like 1 year younger than me, none of them know how. I don't know how, for one great reason, that it's sort of, first of all, it's a very hard language, and I'm dyslexic and very bad with sounds and vowels and all that. But there was also a common practice of laughing whenever a white person spoke an Inupiaq word, and I was already being laughed at for being small and white and different and wearing too many furs. And so I didn't want anything that made that worse, standing out racially. And so I weeded out the so-called Eskimo words from my language. I used to use them all that I knew, 100 or so words. And I slowly weeded most of those out of my language. You know, once again, this is touchy ground, and it's obviously just my opinion, but it often seems like there's certain things that people consider their own. And so the Inupiaq language, I often feel, is like people want that to be theirs.
We're speaking with Seth Kantner. He's the author of the novel Ordinary Wolves, and his new book is a memoir and collection of his wildlife photography called A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou. Up next, I'm going to ask Seth how he convinced a woman from Boston to join him in the Arctic. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. My guest is Seth Kantner. He's the author of A Thousand Trails Home, Living with Caribou. So you're still living in the sod house, and you managed to convince someone from Boston to marry you and to move in. So I want to know how you convinced her and what drew her to the Arctic.
So when I was 16, my brother and dad and I cut trees and used a chainsaw to make boards and built a new sod insulated home about a couple hundred feet from the old moldy falling down sod igloo. And the new place is larger, still built in the ground, insulated with moss, but a bunch of windows on the south side, sort of for solar gain, so to speak. And so that house was a little nicer, bigger. And as far as meeting a woman, I always swore I was going to be a trapper and a hunter, but fur prices dropped horribly. And I was 18 and unsure how to proceed living alone along the river. And my parents moved away. And so I went to college with one goal: to meet a girlfriend. I had no interest in going to college and certainly no use for a degree. I was horrible at that endeavor and found out girls were not impressed with guys who only can skin Wolverine and run dogs and not talk very well and stare at the ground too much. And so I dropped out. I went back north to commercial fish for salmon. And there was this stray tourist from Boston, my wife. And that's how we met. It was very rainy, and she was with a friend and put up a tent, and they were all wet in their tent, and I was living in a tent. It took a couple more arduous years to talk her into coming north. And once she did, I have to admit that I was pretty good at providing a crazy wilderness experience out among the bears and wolves and thousands of caribou, but at the same time being quite the caretaker as far as making sure, you know, she was warm and well fed. And I'd run back out and cut up some more caribou frozen steaks and bring them in and stoke the fire. And so for a certain number of years, I think I was doing a lot of making it more comfortable than maybe it would have if she hadn't been there. And then as the years went by, she became more and more accustomed to that. I don't want to ruin the romantic vision. We've had lots of good years, but we're no longer together now. And we have one daughter, and they're living in Kotzebue on the coast where I still commercial fish and spend some of the year. So we're still all family and very good friends.
So, Seth, you have one daughter, and I'd like you to just kind of tell us what your hope is for her and her future in Alaska.
Well, that was very confusing for me when she was young because I didn't know if I should teach her how to skin caribou leggings or whether she should be studying. She was studying Latin when she was like 10. She was kind of homeschooling herself, and it's really hard in this life where my wife's from Boston and grew up very different views of society. And then there's me, you know, out there wondering when the next grizzly bear is going to come in at night and hoping it's the meat is good. So what do you teach your kid? And then when my daughter was young, she was very small and sensitive and white and got picked on terribly in the Kotzebue school for those things. And so we sent her to boarding school back east, which was turned out to be the top. She got into the top schools in the country and went to Andover back east, and then went on to Stanford, and in a lot of ways ended up, you know, with this desire like her dad to make the world a better place. And she was talking about moving to Berlin or maybe California after school, but COVID brought her home. And so she's been here in the Arctic for the last year and a half and working different jobs. And it presently seems like she's going to stay here, which to me is wildly exciting. And I'm really wondering what she's going to do next. I know she's got involved with some environmental movements to try to stop some big mining roads they want to build into this to caribou country here. And so I'm very excited to see what she's going to do with that amazing education and her own desires.
We're speaking with Seth Cantner. He's the author of 1,000 Trails Home, Living with Caribou. I'm curious if the caribou are still as big a part of your life as far as hunting goes. I'm obviously, as a photographer, you spend a lot of time tracking them with your lens, but do you still hunt them and use them in the way that you did as you were growing up?
I do. And so I just came to the village a couple days, yesterday, for this interview. Mm-hmm. And every person I've bumped into is, seen any caribou? And I'm like, no, I haven't seen a single one. Next person, seen any caribou? And so everybody, especially fall time, is looking for caribou to hunt. And I'm no different. I eat caribou most days of the year, really, if I'm not eating salmon or muskox or moose or bear or goose. And then also still dry a lot of caribou for lunches and whatever else. And so in that sense, caribou still is important. I can't say that any of us are in a ancient situation where we'll starve if the caribou don't come this year. Mm-hmm. There's tons and tons of imported food, especially since COVID. There's just endless stuff being brought in. And so nobody will starve. I don't know anybody wearing caribou parka or caribou mukluks anymore. I'm one of the only people I know who, you know, when I go camping, I sleep on caribou hides. And so there's those ties, but psychologically, I feel like there's, when there's no caribou, we're feeling that tension. We're not starving, but we're still feeling that tension of, I need to get meat. My body feels right when I'm eating caribou meat. Mm. So I can eat, you know, imported whatever, chicken. But in order to spiritually, I don't know if that's the right word, but it's a lot of forms of connection to the land all glued together that make, so hunting caribou is still very important.
I'm curious about what you hope this book does for people who will probably never visit Alaska. What vision you want them to take, to keep with them about the caribou?
Caribou are amazing and so tough what they deal with. I have endless photos of them and falling through the ice in front of me and struggling to get out and getting out like it's nothing and going on with their migration. And so I guess I want people to understand that the natural world is out there all around us, struggling. And this change, any change that happens, is incredibly hard on the natural world. And if we're paying attention at all, we need to realize it's incredibly hard on us too. So we think we can just buy more of this or get more apps for our phone, but we can't survive too much change too quickly any better than the natural world can. And I think people are fooling themselves about that. And I would like them just to read this book and understand strong connection to the land can tell you about yourself, really.
Seth Kantner is the author of 1,000 Trails Home, Living with Caribou. Thanks for joining us today.
Oh, great. It's been great.
Thank you. This is Tenery Taylor. You're listening to Constant Wonder. Next on Constant Wonder, we're staying up north in Alaska to get up close and personal with brown bears in Katmai National Park. Even if you never go to the park in person, you can watch the bears fishing at Brooks Falls. We'll tell you how on Constant Wonder. BYU Radio is taking part in 10,000 Acts of Service, sponsored by JustServe.org. Visit their website to find service opportunities where you live. This is Constant Wonder. Welcome back to Constant Wonder. I'm Tenery Taylor. Mike Fitz is the author of The Bears of Brooks Falls, Wildlife and Survival on Alaska's Brooks River. His organization, Explore.org, has got a very special webcam that takes viewers from all over the world right into the river at Brooks Falls in Alaska's Katmai National Park.
You get to see individual bears not only for a few minutes, but sometimes for hours, days, and even years. A lot of the bears that use the river come back season after season. So we see young bears grow into adults, and so we see adult bears grow into older bears. So yeah, it's a remarkable wildlife watching opportunity and quite unique. I mean, compared to most other wildlife viewing experiences in national parks, you might see a bear on a hillside if you go to Yellowstone or Denali, for instance, but that's kind of an anonymous individual. You don't know a lot about that bear's life history, but at Brooks River, it's very different. We know quite a bit about how they use the river and how they've grown over time.
And I just want to clarify, these are brown bears. Will you just remind us, how are brown bears and grizzlies and Kodiak bears, how are they all related?
Well, they're all the same species. So when you look at their scientific name, they're all lumped under Ursus arctos. However, what you want to call it, whether you want to call it a grizzly bear or a brown bear, just really depends on geography for the most part. Mm. Brown bears are generally considered to be bears that have access to coastal food resources. They live closer to the ocean, for instance. So that would be bears like in coastal Alaska, like in Katmai National Park, versus a grizzly bear that lives farther inland that doesn't have access to like a food resource like salmon. So that would be bears that you might find in Denali National Park or Glacier or Yellowstone.
And how big are these bears that we're talking about?
Yeah, that's one of the differences between inland grizzly bears and coastal brown bears is that the brown bears are much larger on average. A bear in Katmai National Park, for instance, in midsummer, an adult male is going to weigh 700 to 900 pounds on average. Ooh. So big dudes overall. And the biggest bears in Katmai National Park are 1,400 pounds or more. In fact, a bear that we watch frequently on the webcams at this time of the year, number 747, he's a giant. He's well over 1,000 pounds right now. And in the fall, he's over 1,400 pounds. So a really, really big, big guy.
Mm. And I would like to get to know some of their personalities since you said you've really learned about them. So 747, is he kind of the alpha male of the group?
You know, he started doing that this year. He's always been, since he reached adulthood and he grew into that very large size, he's always been a fairly dominant bear. But he's been subordinate to one other bear in particular over the past decade, number 856. And 856 was the river's most dominant bear during that period of time. And that's kind of a remarkable stretch for a bear to be as dominant as he was. 747, though, was a competitor with 856 for fishing spots and for mating opportunities. Mm. For whatever reason, I'm not sure why 747 decided he didn't want to challenge 856 consistently until this year. And 856 taking a little bit of a step back. He's kind of an older bear. He's about 20 years old. And, you know, living life at the top of the hierarchy is kind of rough. I mean, you got to assert yourself. You want to establish your dominance and make sure that other bears are going to yield to you. Maybe those things have just kind of caught up with him over time. Hmm. And 747 isn't much younger than 856, but he's bigger this year and seems more willing to assert himself. And 856 doesn't seem like he's willing to stand up to 747 anymore.
Mm. How about, I want to hear about a female, Beadnose. She sounds really intriguing to me.
Beadnose was one of my favorite bears to watch. She was always around the river. When I started working at Brooks River as a ranger in 2007, she was one of the first bears that I saw with spring cubs. So she came down to the river. She had, I think, three cubs originally that year. And she's also very distinctive with blonde ears and sort of like an upturned muzzle. So easy mm-hmm. to recognize. So it was great to watch her along the river. And when she was not caring for cubs, I mean, she ballooned into a really fat, beautiful bear in the fall. So she was really good at fishing, an excellent bear on the lip of Brooks Falls. So an excellent angler in that location. Unfortunately, we haven't seen her in at least a couple of years. Mm. It's possible that she, you know, found another place to make a living, but from the bear monitoring records at Brooks River, she had used Brooks River every year of her life up until I think 2019 or so. So it's probably more likely that she's deceased, but we can always hope that she found greener pastures mm. somewhere else.
Mm. Maybe tell us about one more bear, one of your other favorites.
One of the other bears that is particularly interesting to watch, especially this year because she's still raising yearling cubs, is number 128, and she's nicknamed Grazer. She is the most defensive mother bear I've ever seen. And mother bears have a reputation for defensiveness. That's one of their characteristics. But Grazer takes it to another level. She does not tolerate the close proximity of many bears. And she'll even challenge some of the large adult males if they come into her vicinity. So she's more willing to stand her ground. She's more willing to attack those other bears if they get too close. And that provides her with a lot of advantages. I mean, it's a risk that she's taking for sure. But Grazer also is able to occupy maybe fishing spots that some other bears can't. And her yearlings are giant for their age. I mean, she's really setting them up for success. And she's very conspicuous on the lip of the waterfall as well this year. So that's another bear that a lot of bear camp viewers this year have been watching with interest.
So how big are the falls? And kind of tell us a little bit about this river. Is it a huge river?
Brooks River isn't very big. Its physical nature is kind of ordinary. It wouldn't stand out in Katmai's landscape. I mean, Katmai is a big national park, about 4 million acres. It has these amazing volcanic resources. And the coastline of the park is intricately carved with many deep fjords and these towering mountains that rise above the sea. And then, you kind of have Brooks River that's only a mile and a half long. It's stuck between two lakes in the inland part of the park. And it's a beautiful setting, don't get me wrong. But the physical nature of the river isn't really something that you would pay attention to. So really what makes it special is the gathering of brown bears and salmon at the river. Mm. And the waterfall kind of makes that happen in early summer. The waterfall is located about halfway between the beginning of Brooks River and its end. The river about a mile and a half long. And the waterfall, on average, maybe 6 feet high or so. So it's not like a cascade or anything like that. It's just kind of like one single drop. And bears will stand on the top of the waterfall, and they'll fish in many locations below the waterfall, just depending on their skill and their dominance and where they can.
You keep talking about how big the bears get in the fall. So how much weight are they putting on over the summer? And is it primarily from fishing salmon?
In Katmai, the bears will gain several hundred pounds for the adults, I should say. A bear like 747, who I mentioned at the beginning, maybe a 1,000-pound bear or more right now. He'll be 1,400 pounds or more in the fall. During hibernation, they lose sometimes a third of their body weight. So really that's what they're working towards, is they're trying to eat a year's worth of food in 6 months or fewer to survive that hibernation period for them. Younger bears, though, actually grow at a fast, or gain weight even proportionally at a faster rate than the adults. I mean, you can think about how big 747 is, but a young independent bear, one that's recently weaned from mother and is living life on its own for the first time, those 2.5 or 3.5-year-old bears, they may double their body weight over the course of summer. So if they're, 200 pounds at the beginning of summer, it's not uncommon for those bears to weigh close to 400 pounds by the end of the summer. And then the spring cubs themselves, those first year cubs, when they're born, they're only 1 pound. So they're very small in proportion to the size of mother. But by the time they go to their den, they could be 60, 70 pounds or more.
Wow. So I'm thinking for these adult bears and maybe for some of the older juveniles, how much salmon do you have to eat in a day to put on hundreds of pounds over the summer?
A lot is the short answer. There's a bit of a longer answer too. It depends on their activity level, their metabolism, how big the bear is. A large adult male, when he's being active and he's pursuing females during the mating season, like in June, he may be burning as much as 9,000 calories a day from some metabolic studies that have been done in the past. A younger bear won't need as much energy, but they can recuperate, those calories pretty quickly by just eating a couple of salmon. So when salmon arrive at Brooks River in early summer, those sockeye salmon contain about 4,500 calories of digestible energy for a brown bear. So even an adult male could make up and meet his daily energy needs by eating just a couple of salmon. But of course, to make a living through the whole year, and you need to eat a lot more fish than that. And the bears will take advantage of the situations as it's presented to them. I mean, they really do live in a world of feast and famine. So they're just not looking for meeting their daily energy requirements, but getting ahead of the game as much as they can. So some of the large adult bears, males and females, can eat dozens of fish in a day when the fishing is good.
Mm. Now let's talk about the salmon. You say when they return, they are full of calories. I assume that's because they're very fatty when they're coming back to spawn. Will you just kind of remind us about their life cycle and why it's important for them to survive, that they have to bulk up so much?
Salmon are remarkable creatures in so many different ways. One of the things that makes them remarkable is when they re-enter fresh water, when they enter fresh water, they're heading upstream to spawn and to die. It's a one-way journey. But their whole bodies don't completely transition over to a freshwater existence. For example, their digestive tract doesn't really support food anymore once they re-enter fresh water, if they could even find anything to eat. So that's another thing about their freshwater existence. When they're coming back as adults, there's really not anything in freshwater for them to eat. And they have a one-way journey back into freshwater. They're going there to spawn and to die. So they're seeking their place of birth for most of the salmon. will go back to the same stream, sometimes the same place in the same stream where they were born. And to fuel that journey, they need to have a lot of energy reserves within their bodies, so fat and protein reserves. And when they're fresh from the sea, they're particularly high in fat. And I think that's why people often prefer to eat salmon. And that's why we don't catch salmon at their spawning grounds necessarily. We catch salmon when they're re-entering fresh water, because the flesh and the bodies of the fish contain a high level of fat, proportionally speaking. If you were to catch a salmon after it spawned, not only would the fat content be minimal, but the flesh itself would have changed inconsistently. It's much softer at that point in time because they have expended so much energy to fuel their upstream migration and spawning. And some of the sockeye salmon that go to Brooks River to spawn will be in fresh water for two, sometimes 2.5 months without eating. And they're, it's a remarkable feat of endurance.
So there at Brooks Falls, how close can people get to the bears?
At the waterfall itself, there's a wildlife viewing platform that visitors can stand on, and you're elevated off of the ground about 10 feet, so you're physically separated from the bears, but the bears are right below you. Sometimes they walk underneath the platform. They're in the river in front of you, and you're really only about 30 feet from the river's edge at most. And the river itself in that location isn't very wide. It's only, well, it's less than 50 yards wide in that spot. So you can have these really remarkable wildlife watching opportunities right there at the falls. And elsewhere along the river, it's not uncommon because there are so many bears concentrated in this area that people are sometimes within 50 yards of bears. It's not uncommon to find a bear using the same trail as you, for instance. If you're walking through the forest to get to Brooks Falls, you got to walk through this spruce forest to get there. And the bears use the same paths as people. So sometimes you have close encounters along the trail or even near the lodge at the mouth of the river.
That seems scary.
It's unnerving the first few times that you experience it. Certainly it was for me. The thing that makes the experience at Brooks River safer than maybe some other bear encounters that you might have is that when we can behave predictably around bears, then bears can learn to behave predictably around us. So the bears at Brooks River, for the most part, are used to encountering people on the trails. So I think it's very important to remain on designated trails to watch bears from designated wildlife viewing platforms. That gives bears an opportunity to kind of learn to work around us. And then also park rangers provide mandatory orientations for everyone who arrives at Brooks River. So you show up on your float plane, you get off the plane, you walk on the beach. The first thing you got to do is go to the small visitor center there and talk to a ranger about how to behave in bear country. So that process helps to set people up for success. But it's really the predictability of the situation that helps make it safer, and the ability of the bears to, for the most part, to adapt to the presence of people.
Have you ever had people who just insist, well, I got to get in the water, I got to get up close to get a great shot, and do something that makes the bears feel threatened?
That does happen, unfortunately. For, the high concentration of bears that happen at Brooks River and the number of people that visit, this year, Brooks River is on track, just a little bit of background, on track for about 14,000 visitors, which is equivalent to what happened in 2019 pre-pandemic. And that was a record year in 2019. So there's a lot of people visiting that place, but your movements aren't really restricted by regulation or law very much. There's only a small area around Brooks Falls that is closed to people from June 15th to August 15th. But when you're watching the webcams, it's not uncommon to see people fishing in the river or photographers in the river. And occasionally people do want to have, personal close encounters with bears. And when you're in the river, I mean, you are occupying the space that bears need to survive. And with increasing numbers of people visiting the river, that's why I'm trying to emphasize to anyone who wants to visit or has the opportunity to visit in person to stick to the wildlife viewing platforms, because we're consolidated in those predictable spots. And that just gives bears more room to make a living in the river, because not all bears are tolerant of our presence. Some of them will walk through the river with people nearby, but a lot of them just avoid the area completely. So it can not only be a safety issue for us, but it also can be a survival issue for some of those bears who feel displaced.
I wonder if, given the concerns you have for the bears and also for people's safety, do you ever see a time in the future where you have to turn people away from the national park? I mean, could you do that and should we do that?
It's a question that I've pondered a lot over the past several years. And crowding issues and conflicts over space with between people and wildlife, that's not a unique issue for Katmai National Park. It's actually something that a lot of national parks are experiencing mm-hmm. right now. I mean, more and more people want to visit these places. So the challenge, though, is that a lot of these places have, you know, finite carrying capacities for people. Like, the facilities can only handle so many people on a daily basis. There are only so many rangers to give bear orientations. And at Brooks River, you know, we could go in one direction where we put up grandstands and allow 500 people to stand at the waterfall and watch bears fishing there. Or, you know, maybe we make a choice and say, you know, day use can't go beyond a certain threshold. In the 1990s, the National Park Service proposed that for Brooks River, and due to political opposition, those changes were never implemented. So I think the National Park Service has seen the writing on the wall about this for a number of years, but it's getting to a point right now where I'm wondering what that threshold is that we're willing to accept as far as resource impacts when we're talking about how we're affecting brown bears at the river, or the overall experience. Right now, the viewing platform at Brooks Falls is limited to 40 people at a time, but you may have, you know, 400 people a day trying to get on to the viewing platform. Mm-hmm. And you can, rangers try to manage that by imposing a time limit for how many people can, or how long you can be on there. It's just that, you know, whether people want to accept 3-hour waits to get onto Brooks Falls, like you might have in an amusement park for mm-hmm. a popular ride, is something that's an unanswered question right now. And I think the park is going to have to think more seriously about that now and in the near future.
California wildfires. We've seen the photos, heard the tragedies, even smelled the smoke across the U.S. Imagine now encroaching flames suddenly arrested, not by firefighters on the ground or airplanes dropping water from above, but by a grove of banana trees. Banana Buffers, Tuesday on Constant Wonder. Constant Wonder is a production of BYU Radio.